And we're back. In this next half hour, we're going to be talking with Coventina Waterhawk. She is the author of Duly Diagnosed, Duly Blessed, From Struggle to Purpose. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
As I mentioned in the opening, the book is a very personal look at not only your struggle, but also some other people once you get done with your part. There are some other voices who are going through the same thing, but from their own different perspective. And so that is very helpful, I think, for the readers to get a more fuller understanding of what it is you're talking about. So duly diagnosed is diagnoses with both substance abuse and mental health issues. So kind of talk about your own story there. Were you diagnosed at the same time or did those come at different times?
And did one lead to the other?
Right.
Well, I started my journey at 7 years old with suicidal ideation. And I used to write poetry about it. And I tried to share one of them with my best friend, and it backfired because she turned her back on me instead of being supportive. So right away at 7, 8 years old, I felt betrayed and
ostracized.
Yes. But I continued to write, and then I had this happy-go-lucky exterior, but inside I really wanted it in my life. I couldn't function in this world with other people. And then I was getting bullied. Back then we called it pick on somebody.
Yep.
You know, we did not know that that was the word.
Right.
You know, and then I was like, for the underdog, it's like, hey, come with me and we'll get bullied together.
Yeah.
You know, and then I found school to be very helpful. It kept my mind preoccupied. Same with sports and music.
And so teachers could be a support.
Right. Except for I never told the teachers how I felt. The stigma has been there forever. And so you're afraid to speak up because of the judgment. And everybody thinks, oh, it's all in your head. And I'm like, exactly.
That's what I was going to say. It's not only the stigma, it's the ignorance. It's thinking that you know when you really don't have a clue.
Right, and people think that it's a choice.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Oh, you're deciding to not get out of bed. You're just lazy.
Mm-hmm. No. You're moody. That was another one.
Yeah. And I try to explain to people that depression is exactly like a concrete slab hovering over you and you can barely breathe and you definitely can't move it. So no matter how hard I want to get out of bed, I just can't.
Yeah.
Like I miss my closest friend's wedding.
Oh.
I said, yes, I was going to be there. And a friend said, you were supposed to sit next to me at the table in the reception. And I felt so bad, but then I needed to accept my condition and my situation. Yeah. They got it. They were like, oh, we get it. You know, but I still felt guilty and bad that I wasn't able to show up. And one time I just couldn't get out of my pajamas. I was supposed to wash my car. I just couldn't. I couldn't function. But I wrote in my book, oh, well, at least I wrote some more. So I did something productive.
Right.
You know, it's that those little things to be grateful for.
Yes.
How old were you when you first got help, when you first got diagnosed and...
Shortly after I escaped from my husband's abuse, I ended up in the psychiatric hospital, and they didn't diagnose me for anything except the psychiatrist said, oh, you're just stressed out over your divorce.
I was going to say you're coming off a traumatic incident, they can explain it away.
Exactly. It's like, oh, and I'm thinking, well, I had suicidal ideation long before I had this relationship. And they just wouldn't listen.
And you told
them
that, and they wouldn't listen. Okay.
Correct. They would not listen. Yeah. I got dismissed so many times that it's ridiculous how many times. One time my friend brought me to the hospital because the suicidal thoughts were just overwhelming me, and I needed help.
Yes.
And so we were joking, and it was like a distraction. And when the nurse asked me, so why are you here? And I said, because I'm really suicidal. I need help. And she said, well, you don't look suicidal.
Right.
And I got right in her face and, you know, What the? You
Please
know what
tell me is, that wasn't a psychiatric nurse.
No, she was an ER nurse.
Okay.
Yeah. And I'm just like,
still,
what
they
is,
should be trained.
Yeah, I'm not. I'm just, yes. Yes. I'm not excusing.
I mean, nobody says I'm suicidal. Just relax.
No.
I mean, that's really, as you say, there's so much shame associated with mental illness and struggles that it's not a light declaration on your on the part of anyone who goes in there who really needs to have assistance. And you need to be and I was glad to hear that you can, in small ways, be compassionate with yourself, understanding that this was external to you, this horrible feeling of concrete hanging over you. But yet, how do you not blame yourself? I think that it is a really very touching struggle.
Yes, because I got right in her face. What is that supposed to look like?
Yeah, yeah. Of course.
And maybe she learned something that day.
I hope so.
Yeah. And Nancy asked earlier if the substance abuse contributed to them. Can you talk about
how vice versa?
How did those feed on each other if they did?
Yes, the substances helped reduce those thoughts to where they were almost non-existent. Because I was always under the influence.
Alcohol or pot?
Yeah,
or?
It was alcohol at first. I attended my cousin's wedding when I was 8, and I shared 2 bottles of champagne with my neighbor friend, and I never got sick. And looking back, when I was first in recovery, and they were teaching me that the alcohol, you know, absorbs in the body of an alcoholic, and a non-alcoholic expels it, and they, you know, they get sick.
Oh.
Now, my aunt... I was the same size as my aunt. She was really petite, and she got drunk, and she got sick all the way home. So that told me, wow.
Even as a child, you were immune to that effect.
Yes. And so my body soaked it up, and her body rejected it. Mm-hmm. And that's how I realized what the difference was between an alcoholic and a non-alcoholic. And non-alcoholics don't even think about, gee, I wonder if I'm alcoholic. You know, it just doesn't occur to them. They might drink a couple of beers. I have family members that, like my mother, she used to take just one sip of her wine and would not get in the car to back it out of the driveway because she was convinced that with her luck, a cop would be coming by and give her a ticket. You know, so I don't understand that. And in recovery meetings, afterward, we go to restaurants to fellowship. And several times, there would be somebody all the way on the other side of the restaurant with a half a glass of wine, and they got up and left it. And here I am, full, you know, around a bunch of people that are, you know, sober, and I'll spot that. And I'm thinking, well, that's alcohol abuse. You're neglecting this.
Somebody's you don't want to
go
to waste.
Yeah, yeah.
Exactly.
So then the alcohol was your first substance abuse. Do you feel comfortable talking about the rest of your journey?
Oh, yes. When I was in junior high, a friend of mine, she lived with our dad, and he went away for the weekend, and she had a party. And everybody was passing around a joint. And I was taking hits off of these joints, and I wasn't feeling the same as alcohol. And I think I brought a case of beer. And I don't really remember how. I know that my next-door neighbor, the older ones, I would give them my allowance, and then they would buy the alcohol for me. So they were passing around the joint, and I was participating. And then I just wasn't getting the buzz like I did with alcohol, and I was sitting on her bed just sobbing. And she said, what's the matter? I said, well, everybody's out there stoned, and I can't even get buzzed yet. So she brought me into the bathroom, and she showed me my eyes. And she said, you see that? And I'm like, yeah. She said, you are so loaded that you totally don't even, get it. You're beyond.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So it didn't really register with me like alcohol did. So, but the first thought in my mind was, well, if I have to pay for this, it's time to stop.
No.
I mean, that's just the way I thought.
Yeah.
I get it.
Yeah. And then a little bit later on, I was participating, and a friend of mine, you know, we bought some, and I need to stop because this is a problem. And then
interesting.
Yeah. And then after my divorce and I had my two little babies with me, that's when my alcoholism just really took off, because during the marriage, we weren't drinking. And so I was completely sober. And the best way to describe me when I'm not under the influence is a rageaholic. Mm. I had so much anger in me, and I can remember throwing my mattress out in the hallway when I was angry at my mom for something. And I can't even do that now, you know, pick up a single mattress and throw it somewhere.
But you just had so much adrenaline.
Yes, yeah. I was. Yeah. So I just I have all of this rage inside, and I just have to, you know, release it somewhere somehow. And that's not really good when, you know, other people are around me. And what people do because of the ignorance is that they judge us by our actions and behaviors and not question and say, hey, are you okay? Are you balanced?
I was wondering that with your mother, seeing this mattress being flung into the hallway. And I guess parents sometimes don't see the obvious with their children.
Yes, and also when after the marijuana, I felt really spaced out, and I shared that with my parents, so they sent me to counseling. Mm. Like, oh, it's your problem.
Was that the first time you got counseling?
Marijuana? When I was 12. Okay. Yeah. And they didn't address it because I didn't really talk about it. Okay. They never asked, and I never told.
Okay. Okay.
And so I never got that help. So my dad was really mad because they spent all of this money to help me and it didn't work.
Yeah.
So they blamed me.
Yes.
One more time, and being blamed for being, you know,
difficult
having,
and
and having problems.
You talked in the book about the first time you hurt yourself, not cutting, but I guess nicking or what? Can you talk about? Do you remember what that was like and how that felt?
Yes. What I did when those suicidal thoughts came, I started snipping the just the skin on my wrist, like just enough to where that pain distracted me from that emotional torture that I was experiencing. And I have done that off and on throughout my life, especially like when my mom passed, I lost the will to live. So I was really fighting with those thoughts for months. And a friend of mine who also has the same symptoms, and she asked me one day, have you ever thought about naming those thoughts, your unsafe thoughts? I was like, no. And she said, well, when you do that, it creates a barrier just enough to where it separates the thoughts and the actions. And the first word that came to my mind was Dracula. And so I can send Dracula on a timeout. I can put him in the freezer, or I can put him down the garbage disposal.
Anything. You can see him coming, I think.
Yes. And when I'm thinking those unsafe thoughts, last year I created a pick-me-up jar. And what that is that you write down little words of encouragement, positive affirmations, or a little action step to take when you're having that moment. And I'm part of this group where you just can't make this stuff up. And one night I had a nightmare that I was on that edge of just ending it. And I woke up and I was sobbing. And then I thought, oh, you have a pick-me-up jar, silly. So I shook it and what came out was, your life is valuable. And I said, yes, it is. And then I just put it back in the jar because I might need that later on.
Right.
So, and the whole purpose of this pick-me-up jar is to come from within you, and it empowers you because they come from you instead of picking and choosing all these affirmations from elsewhere.
Right.
You're not connected.
Mm-hmm.
But when you do it for yourself, you're really connected and it empowers you. It builds self-esteem and self-worth. And so I'm really excited because I get downloads all the time from the universe. It's just like that. And then, you know, hope is my favorite word ever since I began my recovery. And it dawned on me, help others process emotions. And I'm thinking, yep. I've been doing that since I was 10.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Kids used to come to me for answers because everybody knew I knew the answers, just nobody knew how I knew. I didn't even know how I knew. It was just something that everybody accepted. Yeah. You know, and then looking back, I should have charged them their allowance for my services.
And then that's what gives your life meaning. And now you say, my life is important. It's valuable because I can help others. And by helping others, you help yourself. Is
exactly,
that essentially what you discovered?
Yes, exactly. And that was in 2001. I was in a tarot reading class. And we were paired up with somebody. And I didn't even know this lady. I had only met her like the week before. And so we were supposed to pair up and do a one card reading for each other. And she pulled the Justice card. And all I said was, there's a lot of injustice going on in your life. And then the downloads. And I have the vision and the thoughts. And I said, it has something to do with your family. It's like they have this protective wall around you, like you're a bad person. And are there court proceedings? And I thought she was going to faint. And I said, does that make any sense to you? And she just like nodded. And I'm like, would you like to elaborate? And she said, yes, I think she was like in her 50s. And she said, yes, I just told my family that I'm a lesbian and my kids are keeping me from my grandkids and I'm going to court for visitation rights. And I just threw up my arms. I guess I could read tarot. Yeah. You know, and the teacher and the other students, they were flabbergasted by how accurate I was. And that's when my intuition, you know, resurfaced, because after being a kid and other people started to say, well, you're not psychic, you're psycho. You know, things like that. They just wouldn't believe that these are actual gifts that people have. And so a lot of times there's what we call imposter syndrome.
Yes.
And I feel sometimes, well, I'm not the one who has the gift. You know, I just download it. And one night I was at dinner with a bunch of girlfriends, and one gal, she pointed to me, and out loud she said, she's an awesome healer. And I was like, well, I'm a channel for healing, because I didn't want to take that on, because I didn't want my ego to get in the way. And so there's that fine line between ego and truth, and that humility. And it's like, no, I have this gift, I am a healer, and what I do with that gift is, with my clients, I show them that they have the power to heal themselves. So I give them these, it's a wellness plan. It's kind of like a prescription, because I put down journal, walk every day, and then quiet time 2 times a day, you know, things like that.
Actually, that's good advice
crystals
for all of us.
Right. Yeah. Anybody can use.
Yeah. I was going to say, as I mentioned earlier, the first part of the book is your story, and then the last maybe third of the book is other people's stories. Can you talk about, you know, the similarities, what all of your stories have in common, and then, you know, what kind of makes them all unique and different?
Well, what makes them unique and different is the first story is my friend Ashley. She had postpartum depression and anxiety that first year after she had her daughter. So she missed out on a lot of things.
Oh, yeah.
And so in the book, she writes, dear postpartum depression and anxiety. And then she just lashes out at it, you know, because she couldn't bathe. She didn't have the will to live. Everybody was saying all kinds of things to her, like, well, you're just selfish and you want all the attention and it should go to the baby. And she was telling people in her story, no, do not go straight to the baby. Go to the mama and ask her how she's doing, you know, and bring food and help out with the baby, because people just don't get it. Mm-hmm. You know, oh, yeah, postpartum depression, it'll go away. Not for everybody.
And how do you not immediately go to that adorable baby and give all of your attention and all of your love to that adorable baby?
Exactly.
Right? I mean, that's.
And then, of course, the mother stigmatized as a bad mother.
Yeah. Exactly.
Right. It's a vicious circle.
Yes. And then there's a story in there. Becky, she has, it's myoclonus, something, I don't know. Yeah. It's some ear. It's an it's an ear muscle issue in mm-hmm. her eardrum, and it causes very loud, high-pitched noise in mm-hmm. her ear, and it recurs. So she can't get away from it. So she's hyper-vigilant. You know, she has that complex PTSD. Now, complex PTSD versus PTSD is PTSD is a one-time trauma, and complex PTSD is an ongoing trauma, or it lasts for a very long time. And what she decided to do was she started to write comic strips, and now she has, I think it's 7 comic books, and they also have music to them, and it's like really angry and getting that frustration out. And it's amazing to me, because who would have thought, you know, to deal with those, you know, that situation. There's another person that has photophobia, and so she's very sensitive to light, and she always has to wear her sunglasses when she's driving with the visor down. And what helps her is to get fresh air. So she'll roll down the window in her car and almost stick her, you know, stick her head out.
Yeah.
And then there's a therapist that also has issues. And so that's even, you know, a deeper mm-hmm. stigma within, you know, that community of therapists. How can I be there for someone else when I have these problems? You know, and yeah, and so it's really tricky.
Yeah.
And say, oh, I understand, because I had, you know, because she wants it to be it needs to be about the patient and not her.
Yeah, I would think that would be a very, very difficult thing to concede, to acknowledge, especially to your fellow professionals. I feel for her, I guess, is all I could say, because I certainly.
And
we're
yet,
all
I
human.
Think, and I think she would bring an empathy to the table therapists.
I do too.
A real lived experience. So she can hear her patients maybe more explicitly than other therapists who've never had struggles.
Yes, and that's what I feel so empowered by when I tell people that I am a dual diagnosis recovery expert. Because my expertise comes from my lived experience, not something that I learned about. And that's why I feel that so many people can be helped by me, because I can relate, and they know that I can relate, because I just share openly my emotions are on my sleeve. I am who I am. If you don't like it, then that's fine. You can walk away. If you do, great. If you learn something, that's great. If you don't, that's great too. Because I was taught in the beginning of my recovery that we have the seed planted.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happened 22 days before I entered recovery, was somebody dragged me to a recovery meeting. And I heard a message that the speaker wanted to die when she was 7 years old. And I was like, how did she know that? Because it felt like she was talking to me. So that was the seed that was planted within me. And then 22 days later, when I hit rock bottom, it was the morning after I had given up my babies to CPS. I called CPS on myself, and I asked them, you know, please, can you come get my babies? I don't want to hurt them, and I don't know how not to. And I can remember one of the police officers told me he had been on the force for 18 years in child services, and not once had they ever had a parent call for help, and that I was doing the right thing. And that's
because you loved your children so much.
Yes, and I felt like they had a better chance at life with my ex-husband than with me. And people were asking me, how can you do that? Because there were a lot of women that are early in recovery and they want to get sober and, you know, for their children. And then what happens if that doesn't work out?
Yep.
And because you have to do it for yourself
first.
Yes. Because anything outside of that, if something goes awry, then you end up, you know, drinking or...
Yep. Back in the problems.
Yeah.
One of the things I think that also is misunderstood by a lot of people, probably myself included to some extent, is this notion that, you can be cured. You can get like a physical thing, your bone heals, But it's really a continuous process, isn't it?
Yes, there is an organic chemical imbalance in the brain. I can remember one time, I think it was my 10th time in the hospital. And when I kept going, taking my medicine, not taking my medicine. Oh, I'll heal my brain spiritually. And one day, during meditation, I heard, take your meds. And so, okay. And I haven't been in the hospital since because I heeded that message.
Uh-huh.
And I've been able to share with people, well, now, the last time that I was in the hospital was back in 2004.
Uh-huh.
And I've also lost a lot of friends to suicide. And so that's really difficult because of my own symptoms. I try not to should on myself, but I felt like I should have known the signs. But everybody's symptoms are different. Yes.
So you've written this book. Where can people, we're coming up to our last few minutes. Where can people get a copy? And what is the book? What is the title again?
The book is Duly Diagnosed, Duly Blessed, From Struggle to Purpose. And that is people with the co-occurring disorders, with the mental health and the substance use. And they can visit my website at coventinawaterhawk.com and look up the book. And what I want to do is raise funds for the radio mm-hmm. show. And so people that, you know, find the book in the coupon code, just type in KTAL, and then I will know those funds go to you guys.
Oh, that's incredible.
And we should, Coventina, C-O-V-E-N-T-I-N-A.
Yes.
It's not a name, it's a very unique name, so.
Yes, well, maybe sometime I can come back and share that with everybody.
I'm sure that's a story in itself,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Well,
yes.
And once again, the book is it is the story from the people who are living this experience, and for those of us who can be judgmental, who can be ignorant, I think it's it is a helpful thing. Thank you for sharing this experience and this knowledge and helping all of us understand it just a little bit better.
Well, thank you so much.